the edge of the earth. It's a fascinating topic, and there's a lot of debate about it, apart from in the scientific world, in the Torah world as well. It's a fundamental issue to understand. First of all, it's fascinating in its own right, and secondly, there's a lot of questions of emunah, a lot of people who are struggling with Jewish belief, who feel that it's necessary to answer, to deal with issues like evolution, the age of the earth, and so forth, because they seem to pose problems and raise contradictions to the Torah model of the scientific, of the progression of history, let's say, geographical history and so forth. And there seem to be, it seems to be a very wide disparity between the scientific account of the age of the universe and between what we have explicit in Torah tradition. The truth is, from the outset, you should know that there's no conflict between these things at all, because the two, as is often said, in any area where Torah and science seem to impinge on each other, that they're dealing with totally different paradigms. They're dealing with totally different systems, universes, the language terms of reference are different, and therefore you never really have to engage in a conflict between the two. But the point is that often it's seen that way, and it needs some depth to disentangle the possible areas of conflict. Now, first of all, let's state the problem in terms of the age of the earth. I want to try and avoid the evolution thing as much as possible, although inevitably it impinges on this question, and we'll have to raise some of the problems and some of the issues that are raised by evolutionists. And please feel free to ask anything you want as we go along. I was told that I was giving this talk a very short period of time ago, so it might not be perfectly organized. Please raise any questions that I may not deal with fully. The problem, to state it simply, is the following thing. According to Torah tradition, the world is 5,748 years old. Okay? That date dates from Friday, 5,748 years ago, the Friday of the first 6 days of creation when Adam was created. The month happened to be either Tishrei or Nisan, according to discussion in the Gemara, and that's exactly what it was. The accurate tradition going back there, corroborated in Torah sources many times over, right down to a period of some hours discrepancy because of when the sun was stopped by Yahushua, okay, where the astrological computations has to be changed according to the Torah calendar, which is discussed by the sages and fixed now for us. We have now a fixed calendar. So it's quite clear what the age of the earth is in Torah terms. The scientific account of the age of the earth is a very big question. Tremendous debate throughout, with a tremendous range of opinions. As you know, the scientific methods which are brought to bear on this question all have certain very big problems. We're not here to discredit any scientific method. On the contrary, I would like to try and take a line today which will show you that most of the scientific work is perfectly consistent with Torah thinking, and we don't have to discredit it at all. But first, let's point out, let's get things in perspective, that discussing a subject like this in scientific terms is the weakest area of science. What science has to say about areas like this, right? I'm not saying this to discredit them. On the contrary, as I said before, we have to understand that these are issues which science has the weakest say about. The simple reason is that we're dealing with areas that have a number of scientific problems. First problem is that whatever we're going to say can never be checked. Right? At the moment, we do not have a technique of going back 10 billion years, right, and hoping to get back there intact and see what happens. We don't have that option open to us. So it's all supposition, and there's no way to test it. And by definition, many scientific philosophers of science, define the scientific method as being a process by which one postulates a theory and then sets about testing it in the lab, or sets about making the observations that will verify or break down the theory. In the area of the age of the earth, there is no way to set about testing your hypothesis. There's no way to set up an experiment that will check it out, and there's no way to go back and observe the phenomenon. So that makes it a very weak, and according to some philosophers of science, it makes it an area which is not valid to apply the term science to. It's an area of speculation, call it whatever you want, speculation, scientific observation, but to call it a science and attack it as a scientific hypothesis to be checked out is just not valid in the first place. That's a big important point to remember. Another important point to remember, these points have been very eloquently made in a letter contained, which you can read in English in a book called Challenge. It's a very, very elegant and eloquent letter there, going through the issues involved in the age of the earth and dealing with the question of evolution to some extent from a theoretical scientific point of view. No Torah input at all, just a purely scientific theoretical point of view. Speak to me afterwards, I'll give you that reference if you want the exact place. The things which are mentioned there, and which are, should be quite clear, are that another scientific problem with dealing with a situation like this is that we are reasoning, right, from present to antecedent. Now, you know that most all scientific science seeks to postulate the hypothesis and then predict phenomena on the basis of the hypothesis. Now, the way science usually does that is, as I'm sure you're aware, we make a series of observations. Let's take a classical scientific situation. We may, let's say, postulate that situation like this. Let's say we will grasp a phenomenon, right? Let's say this will be let's say we have on one axis, just for example, like temperature. We'll plot temperature over here, and on this axis we'll plot volume, let's say of a liquid, okay, for example. And we start plotting what happens to the volume of a given liquid with change in temperature. Well, if we plot it, and we find, as we do, for all known liquids, with the exception of water, which we won't go into now, which is an open miracle, by the way. You know that if you plot the graph of expansion of water with temperature, you have a totally unpredicted anomaly, which is a fascinating observation, which bears very much on this thing. But let's leave that up for the moment. If you plot those distances with temperature, you get a straight line, or you get a predictable, mathematically described equation. Now, science does not seek to measure every infinitesimally different point on the graph in order to prove its point. What it does is it measures a random sample. That means we'll measure the volume of water at 4 degrees, we'll measure it at 20 degrees, at 50, etc., and up to 100. Let's say that's what we'll do. So we plot only specific points on the graph. And then we interpolate, right, by drawing a line connecting the points, and we then theorize that although we never measured the volume of water at 45.62 degrees, right, but its volume will probably lie on a point connecting the two points on either side of it that we measured. Now, scientifically and logically, you can see immediately that there's absolutely no reason why it should be true. There's no reason at all why it should be true. Accurately, logically, culturally, scientifically speaking. Because you measure a straight line graph like this, and because you can measure this point and show that at this temperature the volume is this, and at this temperature the volume is that, does not tell you at all that on the point in between the volume will be intermediate between those two volumes. There's absolutely no logical reason why it should be that way. Is that clear to everybody? It does not have to be at all. For all you know, the true picture of this graph, which you plotted by plotting these points, may be like this. Right? That may be the graph. There's absolutely no scientific reason why it shouldn't be that way. And it will still pass through the points that you measured and be true. But experience has shown us, right? Experience with dealing with the world has shown us that if you put the simplest common denominator through a set of observations, very often it holds true. And it's a logical and practical way to set about dealing with the world. And the more experience you have with points in between, the more you will, with more confidence will you be able to predict the phenomenon in intervals that you haven't measured. You have to always remember, it's a philosophical point, it's a Torah point, and it's a very important and basic scientific fundamental, that not only is it theoretically invalid, but in practice, they're often surprises. The classical example I mentioned before is that if you took every known liquid in the universe and measured its temperature between 5 degrees and 100 degrees, including water, you would get the same pattern. And if you interpolated in between, made your predictions in between, then you would find that it obeys the equation. But if you then take your graph and extract a prediction beyond the limits that you examined, let's say you then predict what will be, you examined the limits between here and here, and you did it in great detail in between, and you examined it at 1 degree intervals, and then at half degree intervals, and it turned out to be the same, if you then try and predict what will be the volume of your liquid at this temperature, beyond the range that you experimented with, right?
and that you then predict that it will, your mind will continue to a given point, that is not interpolation anymore, but extrapolation, right? Taking out an observation from a known range. That's a much weaker scientific method, right? That's a method of induction which is much weaker than having explored both sides. There's no logical reason why it should be, but experience shows that as soon as you move out of a known range, your chances of predicting accurately a phenomenon are much less. Because many scientific phenomena do a thing like this, and then it starts to occur, right? Such as when you reach a boiling point, there are many cutoff points beyond which your observation changes. Much less likely when you've examined both sides of the range. As you all know, and I mentioned before, if you do this experiment with all known liquids and substances, you'll find a constant relationship. According to the practical way of dealing with science, if you then took a substance that you had not ever seen before and predicted that it would follow the same pattern, you would have a very, very high order of probability of being right. Or, if you took another substance and then checked out its volume at a temperature that you had never checked it out in practice, statistically you would have a very, very high order of probability of being correct. But the facts are not like that. If you take water and you measure its volume in this known range, no matter how carefully you do it, if you then start to check out water beyond this range, you measure the volume of water at 3 degrees, 2 degrees, and 1 degree centigrade, you'll find that the volume is larger than predicted by the straight line. That's a clear miracle, and an outright miracle, as any scientist will agree, and you can understand the reason, I'm kidding you, but the reason you can understand is plain, is that if water did not do that, the consequence would be that we wouldn't be here. Because as the water gets cooler and closer to its freezing point, it becomes denser, like all volume. If it continued that way and became its densest at zero, which means froze, denser than it was as a liquid, ice would sink. Clear? Clear, right? Which means that lakes and oceans would freeze from the bottom up. Right? Which would mean that after one winter, anything that was alive in that sea before is frozen solid and dead now. And the life cycle on Earth ceases. What happens? Water expands as it reaches its freezing point, becomes less dense, floats, and seals the lake, right, with warm water underneath. You know, the ice is a very good insulator, and it seals the body of water and allows fish and life to continue living underneath through the winter, so that the world continues. That is a clear, clear piece of design in the physical universe. I don't think anybody can see it any different. But since today we're talking about pure science, we won't go into the religious implications. Now, dealing with the age of the earth applies this principle to an extreme degree. We are not looking at a phenomenon that fits into the range of observed measurements. We're looking at something that's outside the range. And in this case, it happens to be way outside the range. You have to understand that if we can make observations like this for water, let's say, and then extend it slightly beyond the range, we're in danger. Right? You have to be very clear. If we make measurements on water in this range and then we then interpolate something in the middle, we're in a danger zone. But experience shows that it's a reliable way and a practical way to set about dealing with the world. If you then make measurements beyond the observed range, it's also a reasonable way to deal with the world. Experience shows it often to be valid, usually to be valid, but it's dangerous, as we've just shown. But if you take a system where you measure in the following fashion, you have some parameter that you control, you measure here, and you measure an observed change over here. And you then measure a graph in this range. Right? And you get a straight line, or you get a mathematically expressible function. And you then want to know what the function would look like at this point here, where the order of magnitude between here and here, and here and here, is many, many, many fold. Well, you're in a hopeless area. Extrapolating to a hopeless degree. When you measure phenomena in the age of the earth, we see how things change and age and form and so forth, and we measure those phenomena over a lifetime, even over a number of lifetimes. We go back to the beginning of scientific observation, right? And we measure it over the last 300-400 years. And you want to extrapolate back to 10 billion years ago, what things looked like 10 billion years ago. You understand? You got a hopeless degree of extrapolation beyond it.
Yes.
So it's nothing more than pure speculation what things would have been. I want to give you a classical application of this principle, because dating systems, and it's a very good example to base this understanding on, dating systems fall into this trap to a degree that's extreme. Let me illustrate you the following example. One of the commonest dating methods is carbon dating. Now,
the problem is like this. If you read a textbook at a low level, a high school textbook, a junior college textbook, they'll tell you that certain fossils were found and proven to be 50,000, 100,000, 200,000 years old because carbon dioxide, and that's a fact. End of story. But the facts are not like that at all. The correct scientific way to express that information would be, according to the assumptions involved in carbon dating, right, which are tremendous degree of extrapolation into a range of unknowns, and given that all the assumptions we're making within the range are correct, then it would seem that this fossil is X amount of years old. That's the scientific jargon, and pure, once again, let me just finish this point, pure logical jargon, which would be quite correct. There's such an egocentric view of these things in the scientific community, they don't bother to give you the assumptions. They say that this fossil is X amount of years old. Yeah? Let's give them the due credit that they expect you to know that there are many assumptions involved. Well, at junior level, very often people don't do that. The junior, the high school student reading his textbook thinks that X fossil was found, right, which is a Neanderthal skull or a piece of a jawbone or something, and is accurately dated to be X amount of years old. If you go to the literature, you'll find that the arguments surrounding those three teeth or of the jawbone ranges over millions of years, orders of magnitude it ranges. Right, first of all. And even if you had close agreements in terms of the range, you then run into the problem of a scientific invalidity. Now, let me illustrate this with the principle of carbon dating, and you'll see what I mean. It's a fascinating example. Carbon dating works like this. Let me explain to you the basis, and I'll show you how it works in the graph. Carbon dating works like this. It's very important to grasp this example because all dating systems are based on assumptions in analogous fashion. The carbon dating system works like this. You have, I'm sure most of you studied basic chemistry at school, physics and so forth. The system works like this. You have the normal state of the carbon atom, right, which is the basis of organic life on Earth, organic chemistry. The carbon atom has a normal configuration of being C12, okay, but can be excited to what's known as carbon-14, C14, a radioactive form of carbon by cosmic radiation. The formation of carbon-14 in the atmosphere is caused by energizing of cosmic radiation, impinging on carbon molecules and exciting them to a more excitable form. Being more excitable, they're less stable, and the carbon atom spontaneously decomposes from C14 to C12 over a period of time. This period of time is usually defined scientifically and measured as what's known as a half-life. A half-life of an unstable isotope means that over the given half-life, you will have half the amount left in that form as you had at the beginning of the time period. Here's a simple example. If you measure carbon-14 in the atmosphere, and you find that the proportion of C14 to C12 in the atmosphere is X, let's say it's 4%, 5%, whatever it is, I don't know what the percentage is, then it means that if the half-life of carbon-14 is 2,000 years, it means that 2,000 years from now, in a stable sample, you'll then have only 2% carbon-14 because there's a natural decomposition breakdown, right? Is everyone with me? Now, carbon dating works in the following way. If you make the following observation, you find the following fact. If you look at carbon-14 in the atmosphere, in the ambient environment, you find that it has a certain fixed fraction, right? Certain small percentage is carbon-14. If you measure any organic material that's alive, it will, by definition, have exactly the same percentage. Because carbon-14 behaves the same way exactly biologically as carbon-12. That means when an organism builds its muscle and its bone and its tissue, it uses carbon-14 and it's not fussy whether it uses C12 or C14. It makes absolutely no difference biochemically, except that you can measure radioactivity from the C14. But it makes no difference to the organism. Now, since carbon-14 is around and available in the atmosphere in the fixed percentage, it will be reflected in any organism. If you take a tree that's alive today, you'll find the same proportion of C14 to C12 in that tree as you will in the ambient environment, right?
Doesn't that validate the assumption of the half-life, the fact that it's available?
I don't follow you. There's no question about the half-life. Half-life is measurable. There's no argument about that. Now, so you find, since the tree is in balance with its environment, it's incorporating carbon and giving off carbon, right, in its natural turnover of cells and so forth, you'll find that it's in balance with the environment. And therefore, a tree that's alive today will have the same ratio of C14 to C12 as anything else in that. But however, when the tree dies and stops metabolizing, stops taking in new carbon from the atmosphere, from the environment, then what happens is the following interesting phenomenon. You have a tree which has a stable population of C14 and C12 atoms, and the C12 atoms remain constant, nothing changes them, but the C14 breaks down. The radioactive unstable isotope breaks down with time, and it breaks down at the rate defined by the half-life, which means, and let's say the half-life of carbon-14 is 2,000 years, I don't remember, it's in that order of magnitude, I don't remember exactly what it is. If you have a fossil of a tree, if it died yesterday, its proportion of C14 to C12 will be the same as a tree that's alive. However, if it died 2,000 years ago, then it will have half the proportion of C14 to C12 as a living tree. Is that clear to everybody? And if it died 4,000 years ago, it will have a quarter. And so it goes as the half-life causes disintegration and degradation of the C14. Is that clear? Now, if you find the fossil of a tree with zero, right, very, very, very little C14, it means it's very, very old. Because the tree's been around a heck of a long time, and over those thousands of years that it's been fossilized, the C14 is constantly breaking down at the rate given by the half-life until you end up with almost no C14. And therefore you have a dating system which is usable. Now, okay, everybody's with me thus far, right? Now, if you think about it carefully, you'll realize that this system of dating is based on a massive assumption. Clear, right? The assumption is the following thing. Let's say you find a fossil, and you measure the C14 in the fossil, and you find that it has very little C14, okay? You make the assumption that it's very, very old, right? And the C14 that it started with the same proportion as C14 to C12 now, and over the eons it's been degrading. But there's a massive assumption being made, and that is that 50,000 years ago when that tree died, you are assuming that the C14 ratio in the atmosphere was the same as it is today. It's a fundamental assumption. That means that 50,000 years ago this tree died with the same 5% C14, right, as a tree today. And over 50,000 years the 5% is broken down to 0.0005. But who was around 50,000 years ago to say, right, that the ambient level in the atmosphere was the same as it is now? Scientifically, and the further back you go, the longer, the older things you want to date, the weaker becomes your assumption, right, that the level in the atmosphere is the same. Postulate, for example, to yourself, a system in which C14 is not constant. Let's assume, for argument's sake, that there is more and more and more and more C14 all the time being formed. Assume it's possible, right? Which would mean, the further back in time you go, the less and less and less C14 there would be around until you reach some time point zero. Let's assume that time point zero is not so long ago, not 50,000 years. Let's assume 10,000 years ago, right? There was no C14 around. It's possible. We don't know. And the tree died then. You now have a 10,000-year-old tree with zero C14, right? Why? Because when it died, there was no C14 around for it to have inside it. You measure it now, and you date it 50,000 years or 100,000 years old. Right? You with me, everybody? Everybody clear? Now, a few years ago, some fascinating work was done by a French team to check out the assumption. You want to be a scientist? Let's check out the assumption. And they did the following work. They checked out, I have the reference at home if anybody wants it, I can give you the reference of the work. This is what they did. They set out over a period of some years to measure C14 levels in the environment to see if it's constant. Your dating method is not valid unless you can be sure that your tree died whenever it died with the same ratio as you have now, as I've explained to you. So they set out to measure the levels, and they found the following very amazing phenomenon. They found that at one point when they measured the ratio in the atmosphere, they found a certain level of this time, right? This axis is time, and this level is percentage of C14. Apologize for the quality of the blackboard. They measured at a certain time, some years ago, the ambient level of C14, controlled set of experiments, and they found it to be a certain percentage. Then sometime later, they measured the C14 percentage again, and they found it was not constant. Not at all. In fact, it had gone up. I'm exaggerating the slope of the curve, right, just to put it to my graph.
They found that C14 levels were now higher.
They were very surprised, and they measured it again sometime later.
And they found that the level was higher.
And they kept doing these experiments and measuring the C14 percentage, a very sensitive equipment.
And they found that the level of C14 over an observed period of time in our lifespan is increasing.
But not only is it increasing, it's increasing at a set rate. And there's a straight line graph which defines its rate of increase. And they were able to explain it. Because the formation of C14, as I mentioned before, depends on energetic cosmic radiation reaching the Earth and energizing or exciting C12 atoms into the state of C14. The more time that goes by, the more C14 is generated. And the rate of generation of C14 exceeds its natural half-life breakdown, right, at a fixed ratio. So they found a straight line graph. And then they did something fascinating. They projected the line backwards, which is not valid scientifically, but it's interesting to do. And they projected the line backwards to a time zero. And you know when that graph hit time zero? 5,700 years ago. I can give you the reference. Fascinating piece of work. Now, nobody claims that that proves the world's 5,700 years old, because the same inherent arguments apply against this piece of work as we are raising against the conventional assumption. Who says that the rate of increase is constant? Maybe over the 10 years that they measured it, the rate was constant, but maybe 15 years ago, or 100 years ago, it took a loop, a dive, went up, we don't know. It's fascinating to speculate about, but we wouldn't lay any bets on that phenomenon. Now, the underlying point here, is anyone not clear on the scientific process? You're not clear.
I have a question about that. Now, you said it's going at a straight line increase, but now the more C14 you have, the more C14 is being converted to C12, right?
At a fixed rate.
Right.
The half-life remains constant.
Right. But
the ratio, you must know that there's a fixed ratio, fixed relationship between the increase of C14 and its natural breakdown. And the one exceeds the other, such that there's a net increase in C14 according to a predictable formula.
But you're saying that the increase...
I think it's a straight line, yeah. It's certainly mathematical.
It should be...
Why?
Going up, right?
Why?
Because the amount of C14, the amount of C12 going to C14 is going to be governed by, you know, the sun hitting the atmosphere or whatever. But the amount of... But you're going to have a bigger amount of C14 going to C12... as you have more C14,
true. But you have a fixed half-life. Half-life doesn't describe amounts. They describe that whatever amount you start with, at a given time, you'll have half.
That's right. Right, but if you have more C14, then you have more C14 going to C12.
But not ratio-wise. But check the report. I can't guarantee you it's a straight line. I can guarantee you, though, that it's a predictable mathematical relationship, which is the same thing. Straight line's also a mathematical equation. Speak to me afterwards, I'll give you the thing, you can look it up. The paper's in French, so, you know, I've only read an analysis of it, but check it out. But we're not here to prove that the world's 5,900 years old by this technique. It's open to all the problems of extrapolation and so forth. All I'm trying to show is that to use a technique which is based on a massive assumption, a person has to remain open-minded and say that if the assumption's true, then the facts are true, but if the assumption's not, we don't know. So the whole system we're working with is an assumption. Now, all radioactive dating methods are based on an assumption. Radio-argon dating, right, and various other methods are all based on the fact that what happened when we say it happened, right, happened under the same conditions which happen now. And we'll come back to this point in a moment. Now, the current theories dating the age of the Earth are split into two camps. Okay, one, I'm sure you all know, two cosmological theories. One known as the steady state theory and one known as the Big Bang theory, right? The steady state theory being that the universe has always existed. There are tremendous philosophical problems with such a position, but that's the idea. The more currently accepted theory is that about 10 billion years ago, the universe originated in a Big Bang, from what no one knows, okay? That originated in the Big Bang. There are tremendous, there's a wealth of scientific information to support this. And there's still tremendous argumentation about exactly how it happened. According to one theory, the universe expanded to 30 million times its original volume in the first 30 millionths of a second, okay, which generates certain very interesting mathematical consequences. It makes the universe very flat, which is a term used to describe the fact that physical laws apply constantly throughout the universe. Very interesting things dealing with relativity and so forth. And be that as it may, something known as the Big Bang Theory, which puts the age of the universe commonly accepted these days at about 10 billion years, which is 10,000 million years old. This age range varies tremendously according to the authorities, but that's what's said. Age of the Earth, did I say age of the universe? Age of the Earth, 10 billion years. And the origin of life on Earth, about half that time ago. Right? First signs of life, in the most primitive form, about 5 billion years ago, 5,000 million years, more or less. Now, tremendous problems. First of all, evolution-wise, that's much too little time. Okay? According to the evolutionists, it's not enough time to have evolved the complexity that we see. It's not enough time to have evolved one enzyme. It's a tremendous problem. This is well worked out, and this research is, anyone interested in it specifically, in 1964 there was a mathematical congress known as the Wistar Conference, which analyzed it in great detail. That can be, you can read that. And fascinating work by a religious thinker called Spetner, published in Nature over the last 20 years, also analyzing the mathematical phenomena involved. Be that as it may, that's the theory. Now, problems, evidence, both sides of the fence, that's how it is. Torah says that we know the world is 5,748 years ago. That's a tremendous discrepancy. Now, both these, the scientific thing, as we said before, ranges back to an area of extrapolation. We can't measure it directly. There are no records from those days. No one was around. And therefore, we're working in the dark. Human history goes back, as I'm sure you're aware, no more than 5,000 years, right? Ebla in Syria and places that have been uncovered recently, which have human and cultural remains, date back no more than 5,000 years, right? So we have verification at least for that. But further back than that, we don't know. How do Torah thinkers reconcile these two positions, right?
Yeah.
I'm not sure what methods they use for those things. They might use simple historical methods, like knowing, you know, cultural development, things like that. I really don't know. See, carbon dating only works on organic material. Cannot date the Ebla tablets and things like that, which are made out of clay and so forth, to the best of my knowledge, by those methods. I don't know. I really don't know. This is published in the popular press, by the way, over the last few years. This is, you can read quite a lot. Rabbi Becher has mentioned to me a very interesting book which you can read on this subject. She goes into these methods of dating and so forth. Dr. Bronner.
Archaeological methods.
I see. So you want to look up these cultural type things, you can look up in that book, which is called Biblical Personalities in Archaeology, tying together archaeological findings with a biblical record and showing how they're consistent. What points of view, what lines can we take to reconcile these points of view? The one easy, you know, the obvious and easy thing is to say science is completely wrong. Right? They're talking about 1,000 million years, 5,000, 10 billion years, etc. Completely wrong. They're fooled into making wrong observations in the line that we've tried to set up now. That's a possibility. And you should know, incidentally, most Torah thinkers do not take that line, but you should know that there is a extensive body of scientific opinion that takes that line. A television program was made a few years ago gathering together many of the leading scientific minds who happen to think that the scientific evidence shows that the world's about 10,000 years old, which is not bad in terms of agreement with 7,500. Leading thinkers in the United States and in England, evidence from the age of the moon, for example, right, the layer of dust on the moon. There's a layer of dust gathering on the moon, right, which according to 10 billion years, according to the age postulated by the Big Bang Theory and by the age of the Earth, as it's accepted in conventional scientific circles, should be much, 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 much deeper. In fact, there was a lot of anxiety during the moon landing, I'm sure you're aware, that if it had been correct, the lunar module would have sank hopelessly below the surface of the moon, right?